get yourself settled and... Well, if we're ready to go, Mr. Jenkins?
John Jenkins, on behalf of Mr. Hicks, if you please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
In this case, the state, through a systemic introduction of improper evidence, so tainted the jury that they were unable to be fair and impartial in coming to their verdict. The first way that this occurred was through bad act evidence. When it was initially brought up, the prosecution, through a leading question, introduced the fact that Mr. Hicks was going to be arrested, prior to being arrested on the drugs, was going to be arrested on other charges. Those charges were going to remain unknown, but then he was going to be arrested on other charges. This was an improper introduction of bad act evidence. The statements said that bad act evidence is only as to those things which are chargeable offenses. That's not the case law. That's not what this court is
saying. So you're right. Did you object, or not you, or whoever was,
yes,
object to that? What did the court do?
A timely objection was made, and the court did not sustain the objection. The jury heard that.
And so you preserved that issue for appeal.
We did preserve that issue for appeal, and that issue was presented before the jury. After that, continuing the same officer's testimony, when that officer was questioned with regard to the arrest that was made, the arresting officer alluded to probable cause introduced, and the question was focused by the defense on cross-examination as to a specific issue, that he was arrested because he was present in the room with the drugs, which was really the only fact that the state had regarding the case. The arresting officer did not disregard the question and elaborated on the question that he was arrested not only for his presence in the room, but also for a statement that was made by the girlfriend. The statement was a hearsay statement. It was being used for the truth of the matter asserted, that it was probable cause. Now, the exact statement wasn't brought in by that officer, but was alluded to probable cause for the arrest was by this statement. The statement's hearsay, the statement is objectionable, and was not admissible.
But the statement wasn't repeated, though, was it?
Actually, by the next officer. So an objection was made at that time. The examination continued on. That officer didn't get into it, but then the next officer who comes up, the question was about the investigation that had been done by the police. The investigation, did you do this? Did you interview neighbors? Did you go to the leasing office to show that he lived there? And the officer testified, no, because the girlfriend gave a statement that he was living there and dealing drugs out of the apartment. That was unsolicited. The door was not opened.
So did you move to strike that statement?
We did move to strike. The judge granted the motion. We actually had sought to address this matter prior to the beginning of the trial, that these were hearsay statements.
Did the judge instruct the jury not to consider the statement?
The judge did instruct the jury not to consider the statement, but when we consider the case that the state was presenting, it was a constructive possession case. The only admissible evidence that they had was that he was present in the room. There was some question about whether he had made a statement that he was living in the apartment, but the officer at the time couldn't remember whether he had said it or not, or was unsure where that information had come from. That was his testimony at trial. So essentially what the state had, he was present in the room where the drugs were found. And so in addition to that, they hear that he's arrested on other charges, bad act evidence improperly introduced, and hearsay statement that provided probable cause, and then they hear the actual content of that hearsay statement, that he was living in the apartment and that he was selling drugs out of the apartment, both a bad act and testimony that he was possessing the drugs.
What was your analysis on cumulative error in this case?
Your Honor, unfortunately, I don't believe it was directly addressed on the fast track.
And that's why I asked the question, because why in hell would this be a fast track case with five issues?
Well, why don't you ask for full briefing in this case so you can talk about cumulative error and go into your presence at the scene of the crime and issues about who owned the, who leased the residence, you know, who was the...
Your Honor, I believe they did a fast track appeal in order to attempt to resolve it quickly as the sentence imposed was not a lengthy sentence on Mr. Hicks, and so in order to try to mitigate some of the resulting error that was present in the case, it was the decision of the appeals team to do the fast track suit.
And not to do an expedited appeal like we're doing right now in the Commerce Tax?
No, Your Honor. That was a strategic decision that was made not...
So he was through 12 to 36 months. He's out now, I assume.
He is correct. Your Honor is correct. He is out on parole now. But this does impact him. It is a felony case on his record.
I understand.
And because the state's case, in a case where...
So he's out now. What difference does it make if he had done a full briefing? I mean, so you'd be arguing maybe next year.
He'd still be out on parole. In hindsight, Your Honor, that may have been the correct path to take. Unfortunately, I'm in a position where I can't go back in time and change decisions that were made.
Yeah, I will understand what happened. I think the problem Justice Sherry's alluding to is you may have a good cumulative error argument, a bunch of little things that add up, you know, like that, where we don't know any of them. Like, I'm concerned the fact that the judge struck that hearsay statement and told the jury to disregard it. Normally, our jurisprudence is that cures it right there. And that one is probably off the table unless it was part of a cumulative error analysis.
Yes, sir. In this instance, because the state's case was based on such a slim amount of evidence, ringing that bell in front of the jury constituted enough error to reverse. It impacted the impartiality of the jury and caused that would be reversible error. Additionally, there was also testimony given by the officer that was outside the scope. They are limited in their officers are limited in their ability to testify as to their own perception.
So the hearsay was stricken.
The hearsay was stricken.
Your Honor, now set forth why mere presence is not reversible in this case. Why is there sufficient evidence to say that there was more than mere presence?
Is there a lack? Tell me the lack of evidence to show mere presence. That's what I'm going to ask you.
Your Honor,
with regard to the mere presence issue, the state did not overcome that burden. The state merely showed that he was present in the room where the drugs were found. There was no evidence, although there was improper testimony by the officer that he was in direct possession of the drugs. There was no observation of him actually having the drugs in his actual possession. And that was a confusing issue for the jury, because if you have someone testifying, well, he was in direct possession, that's him testifying as to the guilt, coming to the final analysis, and while there wasn't a direct definition given to the jury on what direct possession is, there was actual and constructive possession. And having the detective improperly testify, and it was objected to and the objection was overruled, improperly testify that he was in direct possession, where no definition of direct possession was provided, it was easily confusable with actual possession. And it's improper for a detective or an officer to testify in that manner. Because of their position, the jury affords them additional weight, and that additional weight improperly influenced the jury.
Okay, maybe paraphrase.
Is an opinion testimony allowed?
Well, Your Honor, opinion testimony is allowed, but this court, specifically in Cordova v. State, said that cops cannot testify as to the specific issue of guilt or innocence because of their role as a police officer that's accorded additional.
So they can't get up and say, in my opinion, the defendant's guilty, but can they talk about other issues that don't affect the ultimate conclusion, you know, or don't constitute the ultimate conclusion.
Yes, Justice. The police officers can testify, for example, I observed bodies, which were not present in this case. I observed scales, which was present in this case, but which would indicate sale. In my training and experience, these types of things are found in these types of cases. They can testify as to those things, but in this case, he's not testifying as to his opinion. He's testifying as to he was in direct possession. Those were the words used by the officer.
To be kind, is he not testifying as to his perception? And then the question is, on cross-examination, when you have an opportunity to rephrase the question, do you attempt to clarify, or do you just leave it out there?
But if the officer is testifying, he's improperly testifying as to an ultimate conclusion. If he gets up, and it's his opinion that the defendant was in possession of the drugs. It's his opinion that the defendant is guilty. Those are still impermissible.
That's not the testimony that was offered. And you said he's offering in terms of how he perceived the situation. You might have used, and you're proposing, he should have used different words to express what he perceived. Now, do we look at it? How should we look at that?
You know, I believe looking at that is how that statement, or whether that opinion was proper in presenting it to the jury. Possession is the charge. What the state has to prove is possession. He can testify as to his perceptions on what he perceived or what the arresting officers perceived, but as for testifying about possession, when that is the province of the jury, that's testifying to them about what he's
saying. I'm telling you about how it's perceived and stated, because the jury heard the evidence, and he was charged with not only kind of trafficking in controlled substance, kind of controlled substance with intent to sell, which he was ultimately found not guilty. So they seemed to have heard the words that both parties were putting forth. Talk about the substantial evidence, or as you're doing, the lack of substantial evidence from your standpoint.
If you look at the investigation of the case, as indicated in my brief, no detectives were called out. No additional witnesses were contacted to see whether neighbors had indication that he was selling out of the apartment. No neighbors were contacted. The lease wasn't answered. The state didn't successfully subpoena this person who had given a statement implicating my client. There was no fingerprinting done, or DNA done, or any kind of investigation actually linking the defendant to the drugs that were present in the room. What was testified to at trial was that the actual legal resident who they received permission from to search the apartment, that actual legal resident was Ms. Brown. Ms. Brown was a legal resident. It was her bedroom. It was her nightstand. The drugs were present on the nightstand. As for any evidence that the defendant, as opposed to anyone else, was there to exercise exclusive dominion or control over those, as required by constructive possession, there was no evidence presented.
And so we have a 1:57 more to reserve that for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
On behalf of the state.
Good morning, Justices. Maria Lavelle on behalf of the state of Nevada. I just want to correct a few things when I first start up. Counsel indicated that the state brought up bad acts, specifically in regards to a bench warrant that the, or arrest warrant or bench warrant that the defendant had outstanding, which ultimately was the reason he was initially arrested, and then subsequently charges were added in regard to the possession with intent to sell and the trafficking. It was the state that made a record prior to trial that I had, and I was the trial attorney, that I had directed my officers not to mention that he was arrested on a warrant, but rather that he was arrested as a result of the drugs. Now, during the course of questioning one of the detectives, I had indicated to him, and in discussing and discussing the fact that the defendant had told the detective that he lived at that residence, and differing from counsel's representation here today, had in fact testified at the prelim that he lived at that residence as well. Counsel had attempted to sort of impeach his testimony in regards to the fact that he had said that at the prelim by asking him something to the effect of, at what point did he tell you at the prelim that he lived at the residence? And the answer was, I don't recall at what point. And then, well, why is it that you appear to know now? And he said, because I had more time to prepare for trial than for the prelim. But it was in his report, and the defendant had in fact told him that he lived at that particular residence, that that was in fact his home. And so in addressing that, in the course of questioning, I said to the officer, I want to jump ahead. At some point, were you arrested for something other than the weapons call? Because the original call out was in regards to weapons. Obviously, what I'm referring to are the drugs. And the reason I said at some point, were you arrested for something other than the weapons call, counsel immediately objected. We walked up to the bench, and I explained, had he allowed me to continue, it would have been quite easy to see that I wasn't mentioning the bench warrant. I was getting him to CCDC because, again, he gave him that residence as his address when they did the paperwork. At no time did the state ever mention that the defendant was arrested for bench warrant. The warrant never came out by the defense or the state. Excuse me. Pardon me, judges. Mm-hmm. Never was that brought out in front of a jury. They never heard that, so there was no bad act ever brought out in front of a jury. Going on to the statements by Ms. Brown, now, the appellant had indicated that the state had agreed not to bring up statements made by Ms. Brown at trial, and that is absolutely belied by the record. At the same time, when the state was explained to the court that I had cautioned my officers not to mention the bench warrant, counsel, on the record, assumed that the state would not be getting into statements made by Ms. Brown. And if I drew your attention to page 220, lines 23 to 25, the state explained that we weren't agreeing to this and that we did plan on getting into certain statements, but not for the truth of the matter asserted, but to explain why officers did what they did. Further on, counsel asked what specific statements that the state planned on getting into, and I indicated, and again, that is on page 221, lines 7 through 9, and in quotations, the fact that her boyfriend Roderick is upstairs, the fact that initially she said there was nobody there, the fact that she said he lived at the residence. The defense objected. The state, the judge overruled the objection and said they'd come in, and they are non-hearsay.
Why is that non-hearsay?
Because they would not be offered for the truth of the matter asserted.
What's that for?
To explain why the officers did what they did next. For instance, Judge, or Justice Cherry, the fact that they went upstairs was as a result of her saying that her boyfriend Roderick was upstairs. The defense didn't object to that because it had previously been ruled on by the court. The state, however, did not bring out the comment about the fact that the defendant lived there from the officer. That was a recross question asked by the defense, and I'll get into that shortly. The defense then argued that the only reason the state would be wanting to get this information out, the fact that he lived there from the girlfriend, was that so the state could argue that at closing. And I said that on page 221, lines 23 through 24, the state is not intending to use any of her statements as argument because they are not being admitted substantively.
Did you use it in argument?
I absolutely did not. Okay, so having said that, the next thing we're going to talk about, Justices, is the statement that Officer Sulik made in answer to a question posed by the defense during cross-examination. And the question was, do I have the page number? And I apologize, I thought I was so good at this and I did not. But the question was, and the only thing you say indicated that he had direct possession of the drugs was his proximity, is that correct? The officer answered his proximity and also a statement that the girlfriend completed as well. Number one, it's not hearsay because it's not testimonial. He never went into what the statement was. Number two, counsel was aware when he asked these questions of the officers what information they had to make the arrest. And there's certain pieces of information that in the court proceeding you can't get into because there's various rules of evidence that you have to follow. The defense is obligated to be aware of that as well. What the defense was attempting to do through a line of questioning was to show that the officer didn't do his job when he made his decision. So now he's saying to the officer, basically, the only evidence that you had was the fact that he was right next to the drugs. And the officer's like, no, we also had the fact that his girlfriend said, or a statement by his girlfriend, to show that, and the officer is talking about his probable cause. But if in fact this is error in any way, it's invited error by the defense. However, it's still not hearsay because there was nothing said in regards to what that statement was. As we move on,
did you think he opened the door to that, the answer?
Well, the argument was, in fact, it's invited error because the way he's questioning the officer and suggesting that the officer only had this bit of information to make the arrest, the officer, I can't speak for the officer, but presumably the officer felt inclined to say, that's not the only reason that I arrested him. Because for the purposes of probable cause, it doesn't have to be something we can admit in court.
But invited error, when you say invited error, it's like saying that he was purposely doing it as opposed to opening the door, which is a nicer way to do it.
Opening the door then, Justice Jay, I'm happy with that. That's fine. I apologize. I'm not trying to be accusatory. I'm just kind of clear about how things transpired.
Mr. Bell, I don't want to interrupt you. Go ahead with your presentation. The question I'm ultimately interested in is, opposing counsel's arguing there was insufficient evidence. So I'm going to want you sometime to tell me why a reasonable jury could conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that this man was guilty of trafficking.
Thank you. And I will absolutely do that. Let me just finish with this one issue and then I'm done. The argument that Officer Beal's statement where he indicated that the defendant's girlfriend told them that the defendant lived there and he was selling crack out of the apartment. Okay. So the statement the girlfriend said that the defendant was living there was also as a result of the defense opening the door because they asked a series of questions to kind of show shoddy police work. Why didn't she go ask the manager if they ever saw the defendant? Why didn't she go ask the neighbors if the defendant lived there? All of these things. Well, the reality of it is, you don't need to do that when the defendant himself says he lives there, and the girlfriend says he lives there, and the defense knew that the officers had that information. So there's no reason to be looking for clothing. There's no reason to be looking for things with the defendant's name on it. That's what you do when someone's denying that they live there and you want to associate them with something. Then you look for things in that apartment to connect them. The police officers had limited warrants specific to looking for the gun and things associated with them. They could have got a piggyback warrant if they felt the need to establish the defendant's residency to look for additional things. But the defendant said he lived there, and his girlfriend said he lived there. So, again, the officer was responding to counsel's suggestion that he didn't do enough.
It was the defense that asked the question, not you.
It was the defense, not the state. In all of these, it was not the state. And so then the judge gave a curative instruction. And I would say this to justices. It worked because the defendant was found innocent, not guilty of possession with intent to sell. Her statement specifically was, he's selling cocaine from my home. So if the jury did not disregard that, he wouldn't have been found not guilty. In regards to sufficiency, in regards to the sufficiency of evidence, what you have is although the defense has got out of their way in trial and in their brief to suggest that the defendant did not state that he lived there, you had an officer testify numerous times that he was told by the defendant that he lived there because the defense kept trying to somewhat caused the jury to believe that that wasn't the case. And then the state, of course, would follow up with that as well. So the jury heard numerous times from the officer that the defendant indicated that he lived there, and ultimately that the reason that that address was put on the defendant's booking documents was because he purported that to be his address. So we have a defendant living here. We have testimony that there were two bedrooms. One was a child's bedroom and one was an adult bedroom. There's nothing to suggest that the defendant did not share the adult bedroom with his girlfriend. The defendant was found by officers in his bedroom with the child asleep on the bed. The drugs were in reaching distance of the defendant. The defendant clearly was aware that the drugs were there. Counsel had spoken to Officer Sulek and tried to suggest that the drugs somehow weren't there initially because Officer Sulek didn't see them when he entered, keeping in mind that Officer Sulek was still looking for an individual that had been said to have a weapon, and explained to counsel he wasn't looking for items on the desk. He was simply looking at the hands, police officer safety kind of thing. For constructive possession, nothing says that the defendant had to have his fingerprints on it, that there had to be DNA. Nothing says he even ever had to touch it. I could have gone to his home and left it there for him. The question is, was he in constructive possession of that? Did he have dominion and control over those drugs? Could he have taken physical possession of those at any time? It's his bedroom. And counsel would like you to believe that it was his girlfriend who actually was more in possession than him. Constructive possession doesn't mean that more than one person cannot constructively possess. However, again, it's his home. He's in possession of them. It's a question for the jury as to whether or not they believe the officer credible when the officer indicated he lived there.
Excuse me one second. You said that Mr. Hicks told the officer that he lived there.
He told the officer he lived there. And that was brought
up. That's admissible as an admission. I mean, did that come in?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
So this whole thing with the girlfriend maybe be collateral on the hearsay.
Well, again, Justice, I wouldn't say hearsay because it wasn't off of,
Well, if we think it's hearsay, the reason, I don't know if we will or not, we haven't talked about that.
Right.
If we get back and say it's hearsay, I assume your argument would be harmless because he already admitted to the officer that he lived there.
Absolutely harmless. And again, the officer testified numerous times at trial that the defendant said that he lived there because, as I said, defense counsel was attempting to kind of suggest otherwise. So he kept answering that question. So they heard that. They heard how close he was. They heard that it was his bedroom. Because again, there was...
So the child, his child?
I don't know that we ever got that out at trial. I don't know.
Was the girlfriend charged?
The girlfriend was not charged. And one of the reasons that they did not charge the girlfriend, and of course this was not brought to the attention of the jury, but this was information that I provided when I said that we weren't going to talk about the arrest warrant and asked counsel to be very careful as well. Because one of the reasons they chose to arrest the defendant in lieu of his girlfriend was based on his criminal history. But of course that was...
Well, in the old days they used to arrest both. What happened?
Maybe the child, I don't know. I don't know that it would have been incorrect to ask both of them because clearly they both would be aware. But certainly he's aware. We don't know at what point the drugs made it to that room, but we know he's aware. We know it's his residence, it's his room, they're his drugs. And, that's a question for the jury. The jury believed that we had sufficient evidence to prove the trafficking. They did not believe that the state provided sufficient evidence to prove the possession, maybe for the reasons that appellate counsel has indicated. We didn't have packaging materials, those sorts of ledgers, those things. Maybe they wanted more of that. All we had was the scale and the argument that the scale would be used to weigh out the drugs.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to me that they convicted him of trafficking, which is a more serious offense than possession with intent to sell. I assume you could. They're different crimes.
And I'm not sure that they know the distinction, but certainly to prove sales, a possession for sales, there's additional elements the state has to prove up that they determined we didn't prove up. Constructive possession, we don't have to prove that he intended to sell it. We don't have to show money.
The judge shows the amount of drugs.
We had to show them, which we did. We brought in at a chemist. We proved the amount of drugs. So again, you know, there was sufficient evidence. I guess it's the court's decision as to what the threshold is for a jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt. But short of him having it in his pocket, which would be actual possession, I'm not sure that we could have shown any more in terms of constructive possession. Had this not been his residence, we may have had an issue. But the testimony was that it was his residence, he said it was his residence, and the jury believed the officer's testimony, and they found him guilty.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Justices, for your time.
Mr. James, what about that? Did he admit that to the officer that it was his residence?
And, Your Honor, the officer, when he testified, he wasn't unequivocal on how he testified. When he testified, he told him whether he was filling out his the officer's testimony was he said it, maybe he said it at some point, or maybe the boyfriend had told him.
I'm assuming that nobody asked the question with that magic word Miranda.
No.
I guess I'm fast-tracking on the time for stuff like that.
Your Honor, in this case, the state, with regard briefly to the hearsay issue, the state would essentially have Your Honors deem that, look, as long as they don't say it's for the truth of the matter asserted, anything goes to justify the officer's conduct. They could talk about his criminal record. They could talk about the statements given by 30 unnamed witnesses. They could talk about whatever they want, as long as they say, well, that's why we arrested him. None of that is admissible at trial. This hearsay statement that the state got in through their witnesses essentially mirrors the case of Glover v. State, 125 Nevada 691. In that case, there was a statement that the defendant had given a confession. The defense knew about the confession. The state knew about the confession. The state was objecting to the admission of the confession, and the defense knew about it. The defense brought up the fact of the confession. This court ruled that even bringing up the fact of the confession, that he had made that statement, was error.
Counsel, how do you respond to the fact that the state has indicated that you opened the door was opened by counsel at trial to some of the state's questions?
If the state is allowed on any question to just jump into inadmissible evidence, like I said, anything goes. They can go into the fact that they arrested him based on his criminal record. That's why they arrested him instead of the other. Bad acts, any bad acts they want to bring in, they can now bring in because we've questioned their investigation. It opens the floodgates.
And Ms. Brown didn't testify?
No, she did not testify.
And this is a footnote. Professor Irving, remember, on cross-examination, said there's two rules on cross-examination. Don't stop.
And if Your Honor looks at the questions asked, who was directed, the specific question that they got in the hearsay that he was selling the drugs and lived at the apartment, that specific question was, did you ask the landlord whether he lived there? Okay. Seeing that opens the door is a leap.
Anything else you'd like to tell us before we conclude?
I'll submit it to you.
Thank you. This matter was submitted. We thank counsel for the arguments today.